Join Glenn Bleakney on The Making of a Prophet as we explore the hidden process God uses to prepare, refine, and empower those He has called. Join the community at themakingofaprophet.org.
Have you ever noticed how much our brains just absolutely crave predictability?
Oh, big time. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are totally wired for it.
Right. We want this clean, linear trajectory for our lives. Like, you set a goal, you put your foot on the first run of the ladder, you look up, and you just point and say, there it is.
Yeah, there's the top.
Exactly. You think, if I just do X, Y, and Z, I'm going to get there.
Well, it's a very comforting illusion, you know?
Yeah.
We naturally want our progress to be visible and measurable and obviously entirely under our control.
But then you actually step into the reality of a genuine spiritual journey. You get into the day-to-day of walking out your faith, and suddenly that ladder just vanishes.
It completely disappears.
Yeah. You thought you were doing everything right, but the ground totally shifts beneath your feet. And you find yourself in this landscape of transitions that is, well, it's just totally disorienting.
And that profound disorientation, right? Like the shock of having the rug pulled out from under you when you thought you were on the right path. That is the absolute definition of what it means to be truly unsettled.
Which is exactly why we are diving into this today. So, welcome to this deep dive on the Making of a Prophet podcast. We are proudly presenting this conversation on behalf of Awake Nations Media.
So glad you're joining us.
Yeah, and you can explore more of the Making of a Prophet deep dives and learn all about our focus today, Glenn Bleakney, over at makingofaprophet.org. Today, our mission is a spiritually substantive, faith-filled exploration of Glenn Bleakney's brand new book.
And it is such an incredible book.
It really is. It's called Unsettled: The Unexpected Path to God's Purposes, and it officially releases on August 17.
I mean, this book is fascinating because it functions as like a lifeline for believers, for leaders, pastors, really anyone who is navigating a season of intense transition right now.
Which is a lot of people.
So many people. Mm-hmm. And Bleakney presents this core argument that is incredibly counterintuitive. He argues that disruption, uncertainty, and, you know, divine interruption are almost never signs of God's abandonment.
Even though that's usually our first assumption, right?
Oh, right. We always assume we did something wrong. But instead, he says they are unexpected, highly orchestrated pathways into His greater purposes.
So if you are listening right now and you're feeling displaced, or if you are confused, or if you feel like the structures holding your life together have just dissolved, this conversation is custom tailored for you. Okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
I want to start with the psychology of that initial shock. Why does God seem to interrupt our lives precisely when things finally seem to be going well?
That is, that's the ultimate question. And Bleakney tackles it right out of the gate by anchoring the book in his own personal narrative.
The one, right.
Yeah, chapter one. He describes this period in his life where he was, by all accounts, perfectly content. He was leading a thriving, itinerant apostolic ministry.
Traveling everywhere.
Right, traveling internationally, preaching the gospel, pouring his energy into emerging leaders. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't burnt out.
Yeah.
He wasn't, you know, looking for an exit strategy at all.
And he also mentions that he and his wife, Lynn, had settled into a local spiritual community that they deeply loved. They had finally found a rhythm and a place to just truly belong.
Right. But then, completely out of nowhere, a season of what he describes as scattering occurred.
Wow. Scattering.
Yeah. There was this sudden, massive upheaval in the leadership of that church. And basically resulted in the total loss of that spiritual community.
Yeah.
The structures that provided safety, identity, and relational comfort for his life just evaporated.
I can't even imagine.
He describes the psychological toll of that, like how jarring it is to be in a place that once felt like home, and literally overnight, it just doesn't anymore.
It's such a visceral feeling. It's almost like it's like you finally arranged all the furniture in your dream house perfectly.
Oh, that's a good way to put it.
You know, you've got the lighting just right, the rugs match, you've put years of equity into it, and just as you sit down on the couch to finally relax, God suddenly hands you a set of blank blueprints, and He tells you to move out, leave the furniture behind, and build a brand new house from scratch in an empty lot.
That analogy perfectly captures the emotional weight of it. And Bleakney notes that in the middle of this really painful upheaval, his attention was drawn to a very specific verse in the Song of Songs.
Okay.
It's a verse where the speaker says, "They made me the keeper of the vineyards, but my own vineyard I have not kept."
Okay, wait, let's pause there for a second. Why would that specific phrase jump out to him in the middle of losing his entire community?
Well, because it revealed the hidden purpose behind the disruption. Bleakney realized he had spent his whole life faithfully building on other men's foundations.
Ah.
He was managing other people's vineyards, which, you know, is good and necessary work.
Yeah, but God was actually calling him to pioneer. He was being called to cultivate his own vineyard, to build something entirely new.
But to get him to step into that new calling, the comfortable ground of the old calling just had to be cleared away.
Exactly. Which perfectly leads us into a concept from the book that I find both brilliant and honestly kind of terrifying, and that is hell in the hallway.
Yes. Chapter 5. It is such a deeply relatable concept.
It really is.
Bleakney uses this phrase to describe that agonizing, super confusing psychological space between a closed door and an open one.
Like when you know you can't go back to the old room, that door is shut, locked, the key is gone.
But the new door down the hall hasn't opened yet either.
Yeah.
So you are literally just standing there in the dark waiting. And human nature absolutely despises that kind of ambiguity.
Oh, we hate it. Because when we are stuck in that hallway, our immediate assumption is that we messed up. We think we missed a turn or, I don't know, committed some hidden sin.
Precisely. But Bleakney points to biblical precedent to show that this hallway is very often by divine design. Like he unpacks the story of the Apostle Paul in the book of Acts.
Right.
Paul and his missionary team had a plan to enter the province of Asia to preach the gospel. And this wasn't some selfish ambition, right? It was a holy mission-driven plan.
But the text explicitly says they were kept by the Holy Spirit from preaching the word in the province of Asia.
Yes. So they tried to pivot. They go toward another region, Bithynia. And again, the Spirit of Jesus would not allow them to enter.
Which is wild. That is the definition of a closed door. Paul is stuck in the hallway getting a divine no to a supposedly righteous plan.
And the book argues that we have to learn to remain faithful in that in-between space, just continuing to seek God until the new direction comes. For Paul, the new direction only arrived after the initial disruption.
Right, the famous vision of a man from Macedonia begging for help.
Exactly. The closed doors in Asia and Bithynia weren't punishments for Paul's pride or sin or whatever. God was intentionally restricting Paul's movement so he could redirect the entire missionary journey toward Europe.
Okay, so if we accept that the hallway is often a setup for redirection, how exactly does God get us there? Because, I mean, we don't usually walk into the hallway voluntarily.
We almost never do. We really don't. Bleakney outlines a specific framework for this, identifying three primary instruments that God uses to shift our trajectory.
Okay, what are they?
He calls them the disruption of plans, the dissipation of resources, and the dissolution of relationships.
Now, I have to push back a little on that, or at least I'm struggling with it.
Okay.
Because if my bank account suddenly drains or my closest friend just walks away, my gut reaction is not to sit back and calmly say, God is moving me.
Right. It's panic.
Total panic. I want to fight it. I want to pray against it as some kind of spiritual attack from the enemy. So how does Bleakney suggest we actually tell the difference between a demonic hindrance we should fight and a holy redirection we should just accept?
That is probably the most crucial question in the entire book.
Good. I'm glad I asked.
Bleakney makes this profound distinction between the enemy's resistance and the Father's insistence. He suggests that sometimes what we're fighting against with all our spiritual strength, like binding and rebuking in prayer, is actually the gentle insistence of God telling us it is time to let go.
Wow. That is a sobering thought. We could literally be exhausting ourselves fighting the very tool God is using to promote us.
Yes. And the book illustrates this beautifully using the story of the prophet Elijah at the brook Cherith. This is in chapter 6. And it perfectly demonstrates the dissipation of resources.
The dried up brook.
Right. Elijah is hiding from a wicked king, and God miraculously provides for him at this brook. Ravens literally bring him food, and the brook gives him fresh water. He's perfectly safe and provided for. But then the brook dries up.
And Elijah didn't do anything wrong to cause that.
Exactly. I mean, if God controls the rain, why would he let his own prophet's water source dry up? Bleakney explains that the drying of the brook was actually an act of covenant faithfulness.
Faithfulness? How so?
Well, if the brook had kept flowing, Elijah would have stayed in hiding forever because it was comfortable. But God needed Elijah to travel to a place called Zarephath because there was a starving widow there who desperately needed a miracle to survive.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. God used the dried-up resource to force Elijah out of his comfort zone and into his actual assignment.
And it's not just financial or material resources. You mentioned the dissolution of relationships, which is, in my opinion, arguably way more painful than losing a Brooke.
Oh, without a doubt, it is. And in chapter 7, Bleakney uses the historical account of the apostles Paul and Barnabas to explore this.
They were super close, right?
Incredibly close. Barnabas was the guy who vouched for Paul when literally everyone else in the early church was terrified of him because of his past as a persecutor. They had this tight, fruitful partnership.
Right.
Yet, over a sharp disagreement regarding a younger minister named John Mark, they had a massive falling out and parted ways.
That had to be emotionally devastating for both of them.
The human grief of that is very real. But Bleakney points out the macro-level result. God used that painful relational dissolution to multiply their impact. Instead of one powerful missionary team, there were now two separate teams covering twice the ground.
Which really puts the spotlight directly on us. If you are listening to this right now, you really have to ask yourself a hard question. Are you clinging to a dried up brook?
Yeah.
Are you obsessing over a dissolved relationship, viewing it entirely as a human betrayal or an enemy attack, rather than seeing it as God's redirection? Like, are you staying at a dry creek bed out of pure stubborn fear of the unknown?
It's a very uncomfortable mirror to look into, because Bleakney warns that if we fail to recognize God's hand in the closing of a door, we will almost inevitably become bitter.
And that transitions us perfectly into the issue of human resistance. Because once we understand how God uses these instruments to move us, we have to evaluate our own hearts.
Right.
Are we actually willing to move when he says move?
Bleakney explores this by diving into a deeply revealing story about the prophet Jeremiah. It takes place right after the city of Jerusalem has been destroyed by the Babylonians.
A super chaotic time.
Exactly. And a terrified remnant of survivors comes to Jeremiah. They are desperate. And they ask him to pray and ask God for direction of what they should do next. And they made this grand, pious promise. They say, whether it is favorable or unfavorable, we will obey the Lord.
I mean, on paper, that sounds like the ultimate prayer of surrender. Whatever you say, God will do it.
But the reality of their hearts was entirely different. When Jeremiah finally comes back with God's answer, which was a directive to stay in the ruined land and trust God for protection rather than fleeing to Egypt for perceived safety, the people completely rebel.
They just reject it.
Totally. They call Jeremiah a liar, they refuse the instruction, and they pack up and flee to Egypt anyway.
Because they didn't actually want a director, they just wanted a divine cosigner. They literally had their bags packed for Egypt while they were praying. They were just hoping God would validate the decision they'd already made out of fear.
What's fascinating here is how Bleakney connects this to a theological concept. It's the difference between knowing God's acts and knowing his ways.
This is from chapter 2, right?
Yes, chapter 2. The people in Jeremiah's day were operating with the exact same mindset as the ancient Israelites in the wilderness.
How does he define that difference? Acts versus ways.
So the book references a psalm that says, God made known his ways to Moses, but his acts to the people of Israel. Bleakney argues that the Israelites only cared about what God did for them, his acts.
The miracles.
Right. They wanted the parting of the Red Sea. They wanted the manna falling from the sky. They wanted the vending machine God. Their faith was entirely conditional, based on their immediate comfort.
So if there was provision, God was good. But the second there was a disruption or like a lack of water, they immediately accused God of bringing them out to the desert to kill them.
Exactly. But Moses was fundamentally different. Moses pressed in because he wanted to understand why God operated the way he did. He wanted intimacy, not just information or provision.
Right.
Bleakney points out that when God offered to send an angel to lead the Israelites into the promised land, Moses refused to go. He essentially told God, if your presence does not go with us, do not send us up from here.
Wow. He valued the guide over the destination. That is such a profound shift in perspective.
It really is the ultimate proof of a surrendered heart. Moses would rather stay in a barren wilderness with God than enter a land of milk and honey without him.
That's amazing.
And Bleakney makes the case that if we only want God's acts, his blessings, his open doors, his provision, we will abandon him the second he disrupts our plans. But if we want his ways, we will follow him straight into that dark hallway.
And when we do finally surrender the pen, you know, when we let go of our own little blueprints and let him write the story, Bleakney shows how God almost always leads us into the wilderness to prepare us for what's next.
Because that preparation phase is, well, it's structurally non-negotiable.
Yeah. I found a detail in the foreword of this book incredibly striking. The foreword is written by Dr. John Burpee from Destiny Churches.
Oh, yes.
He points out that what makes Bleakney's writing so powerful is that it is completely devoid of bitterness. I mean, Glenn has been through the ringer. He has faced the dissolution of relationships and the painful loss of community. But there is zero resentment in these pages.
Not at all.
And that ties directly into how Bleakney analyzes the story of Joseph.
Oh, Joseph is the ultimate case study in navigating unsettlement without bitterness. Here is a young man who is betrayed by his own brothers, sold into human trafficking, falsely accused of a crime, and left to rot in a foreign prison.
Talk about hell in the hallway.
Truly. But at the very end of his life, when he is essentially the prime minister of Egypt and holds the power of life and death over the brothers who betrayed him, he doesn't retaliate.
No, he doesn't.
He looks at them and says, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good." Bleakney argues that releasing offenses is not just some nice moral suggestion. It is a functional necessity for surviving a season of transition.
Because if you hold on to bitterness against, like, the boss who fired you, or the spiritual community that pushed you out, or the friend who walked away, you are basically handing them the pen to write the rest of your life story.
You stay trapped in the hallway.
Exactly, obsessing over the locked door behind you.
Which is why the wilderness is designed for character formation.
Yeah.
Bleakney calls it discipleship in the desert in chapter 8.
Discipleship in the desert.
Yeah. God intentionally takes us on the long route because promotion without preparation is perilous. If God elevates you to a platform or a position of authority before your character has been purged by the heat of the desert, the sheer weight of that calling will eventually crush you.
And it's in that very specific wilderness environment that God begins to gather the people for your next season. The book highlights the story of David fleeing from King Saul in chapter 12. David has already been anointed as the future king, but his current reality is that he is living like a fugitive, hiding out in the cave of Adullam.
And yet, that dark, damp cave actually becomes his command center. The historical account says that everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discontented gathered around David there.
So the scattered, broken remnant found one another in the wilderness.
They did. But Bleakney issues a massive warning here for anyone trying to build community after a disruption.
What's the warning?
And it is a warning that modern communities desperately need to hear. When you have been hurt, or when you have been scattered by leadership transitions, it is incredibly easy to gather around a shared wound.
Oh, wow.
You find other people who are frustrated with their past churches or angry at their former bosses, and you bond over your shared trauma.
It basically becomes a fellowship of the offended.
Exactly. And Bleakney warns that you must never gather to a lesser thing. If your new community is built on the foundation of a shared grievance, it will eventually turn toxic and implode.
That makes total sense.
You have to gather to Christ. David's men didn't just sit in the cave complaining about how unfair King Saul was. They rallied around David, the anointed king. And because they gathered around a vision rather than a grievance, they were transformed from a band of bitter misfits to David's mighty men.
If we connect this to the bigger picture of our own lives, it really dismantles how we view finding our place. We spend so much emotional energy looking for the perfect church, the perfect city to move to, the perfect job where nothing will ever go wrong again.
Yes, we do.
But Bleakney pivots the conversation in chapter 13 to talk about moving from restlessness to true rest.
And he makes it clear that true rest has absolutely nothing to do with inactivity. Nor is it about finding some geographical utopia where your plans are never disrupted.
No, he argues that true rest is found in the profound realization that home is a person.
Home is a person. That phrase is really the heartbeat of the entire book. When you internalize the reality that your true home is the presence of God himself, you can remain at rest even when your physical circumstances are in total chaos.
That's so freeing.
It is. You can endure the loss of a career, a cross-country move, or the fracturing of a community, because your anchor isn't tied to those fragile, temporary structures. Your anchor is tied to the Father.
So bringing this all together for you, the listener, if you take absolutely nothing else away from this deep dive into Glenn Bleakney's work, let it be this core truth.
Yeah.
Feeling unsettled is not a sign of failure. The disruption, the closed doors, the dried up brooks you might be experiencing right now, they are not signs that God is angry with you or that you have hopelessly missed your calling.
Not at all.
They are simply the raw material of a new beginning, masterfully orchestrated by a loving Father who sees a bigger picture than you do.
I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. A metaphor that builds on everything Bleakney teaches about the hidden purposes of the wilderness.
Okay, let's hear it.
I want you to consider the unseen root system of a massive oak tree. While you feel stuck in that hell in the hallway, while you feel stripped of your usual resources and isolated from the relationships you used to lean on, it can feel like absolutely nothing has happened.
You just feel totally stagnant.
Exactly. But God isn't just preparing the next room for you to walk into. He is using the dark, quiet, heavy isolation of the soil to force your roots to grow deeper.
Wow.
He is ensuring that you develop the internal, unseen spiritual infrastructure necessary to sustain the heavy, abundant fruit of your future calling. Because if the tree grows too tall above ground before the roots grow deep below ground, the first storm will topple it. So don't rush the dark. The darkness is where the roots grow.
Don't rush the dark. That is incredibly powerful. Listen, if this conversation has stirred your spirit, or if you are in the middle of a transition and you really need a guide, you absolutely need to get your hands on this book.
100%.
It is quite literally a roadmap for the wilderness. The book is called Unsettled: The Unexpected Path to God's Purposes, written by Glenn Bleakney. It officially releases on August 17th.
Put it on your calendar.
Yep, August 17th. But you don't have to wait to learn more. You can head over to unsettledbook.com right now to explore the book and secure your copy. That is unsettledbook.com.
It is a phenomenal read. Highly, highly recommended.
And of course, to dive deeper into Glenn Bleakney's teachings and to explore more deep dives like this one, make sure you visit makinggofatprofit.org. Thank you so much for joining us for this deep dive, proudly presented on behalf of Awake Nations Media. Remember, when the architect hands you new blueprints, it's because the house he's building in you is vastly bigger than the one you left behind. We'll catch you next time.